This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network and the New Books and Art Channel. My name is Kirsten Ellsworth, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Amy Von Lintel, who has just published in 2020 Georgia O'Keeffe's Wartime Texas Letters with Texas A&M Press. Amy, we're very excited to have you, and I'd like to start out with the question, what motivated you to compile these letters of Georgia O'Keeffe?
Yeah, thank you, Kirsten, for having me on the podcast again. So the motivation connects to the previous podcast, actually, that I did on the Georgia O'Keeffe watercolors book, which came out in 2016. And I had been working on O'Keeffe's Texas years for a number of years since I moved to the Panhandle myself. I got a job teaching at a local university and discovered, this is West Texas A&M, and discovered that O'Keeffe had taught there at its earlier iteration. It was called West Texas State Normal College, kind of a mouthful, when she was there in the 1910s. So she was teaching in the very department where I got a job. So I started digging around and, you know, to see what was published or what we could know about her years. It was a brief time at the institution, but that's kind of what motivated me, like being in the same department as O'Keeffe. And then I produced the watercolors book with Radius Press and Georgia O'Keeffe Museum that featured her watercolors from her Texas years. But in order to do the research for that, I started reading all of her letters that she wrote from Texas, and she wrote almost every day. So there were a significant number of these letters. They were easily accessible because they were opened up to the public in 2006, which was 20 years after she donated them to the Beinecke Library in Yale, at Yale University. And they had started to be published and they'd started to be digitized. So I could really get my hands on those letters. And while I was doing that work for the first book, I knew that these letters themselves needed to be published. And some of them had appeared in a book that was called My Faraway One, which was about the correspondence between O'Keeffe and Stieglitz. And there's a good long section about her Texas years because she starts to write to Stieglitz at that time. But some of them were not yet published. So I wanted the book to be her voice without Stieglitz and her voice about her experience in West Texas. And so I wanted to include some of those letters that hadn't already been published. Does that help answer the question?
I think so. And I think that listeners and readers will be interested in the fact that you ended up in a job where You're kind of walking the steps of O'Keefe when she was in Texas, which is really kind of incredible. And I'm wondering, as a follow-up question, if you might discuss a little bit about how Georgia O'Keefe even got to Texas in 1916. I think we know of her in New Mexico, right? But how did she get to Texas during the time of the letters?
That's a good question. She was, at the time, she was an educator more than a studio artist selling her work. So she needed money, and she secured the position in January of 1916, writing back and forth to the president of the university, and decided, yes, I'm going to go. I'm going to take this job. I think it was a prestigious position for a young professional art educator, because she had the title of head of the department. Now, the department had one person, it was her. But still, she wasn't just a school teacher at the time. She was a professor, actually, you know, like an instructor at a college. It was a teaching college. That's what a normal school was. And so this was a move up within her art educating career. And she had actually lived in Texas, in West Texas, in Amarillo, which is about 20 miles north of Canyon, where the college is, between the years of 1912 and 14. And she had been a school teacher at that time. So it wasn't a brand new call to Texas. It was kind of like a call back in a way. And so the short answer is that she came for a job. And the long answer might include that she came to a place she was already interested in being in and liked. We don't have a lot of letters from Amarillo years. That's why they're not included in the book. And the book kind of explains this, but she didn't start writing to Stieglitz or Anita Politzer or any of her other correspondents that we know of when she was in Texas or in Amarillo. So that is kind of a blank space or a gap in the knowledge of O'Keefe's life. Maybe something will be discovered, but so far nothing really. She didn't really make a lot of art, and she wasn't writing a lot of letters. But what we do know is the letters in Canyon, she references having been there before and being interested in spending more time there and finding the place beautiful and finding the job interesting. She liked teaching. So she came there for the job, really, that's how I'd answer that question.
Yes. And then so she develops this letter writing habit. And you mentioned, you know, she liked the place. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what we learned from the letters. I have to tell listeners, I couldn't stop reading the letters. I felt like I was having this kind of private, secretive conversation with Georgia O'Keefe, because my takeaway is, in the letters, she's quite opinionated about people, places, other faculty members. If you had to describe her general view of the people that she lived with, the local crowd, what would you say her general kind of thoughts about the people in the place?
Well, and that's, I think, where it gets interesting, because the myth around here was always how much she hated it. Not the land, you know, that inspired her, but the people. She was crabby about their conservative politics, or she was crabby about the wartime attitude, the kind of warmongering attitude. But when I dug into the letters, I found that it was much more complicated. Another kind of misunderstanding that is written back onto her Texas years is that she's a hermit, like not a social person. And I think when she was younger, when she was living in Texas, she was very social. She had lots of friends among her colleagues, among other young women. She befriended a lot of the males at the college, who she wasn't actually the direct educator of, but she would hang out with, like, you know, and go to dances with the young students, including the young men. She would ride in cars with and date, you know, both married men who were about her age, and then also younger men that were students at the college. She was just having a good time as a young person, And she was by no means a hermit. She would talk about how she liked to be alone. It's not like that part of her wasn't there. It was. But she was very social and she really liked certain people. She talked about how, for example, she liked people who had red blood, like red blood cells rather than white blood cells. For her, the red blood meant like passionate and getting out there in the landscape and not afraid to go sit on the porch and watch a storm or, you know, those kind of things, where the white blooded people, she felt like were the people who were, you know, professed to be Christian churchgoers, but then were kind of hypocritical with some of their views or judgmental about the fact that she didn't go to church or whatever. So there were lots of townspeople that she was quite annoyed with a lot of the times, and she didn't hold back her opinions. But I think that sometimes what the received knowledge of her was is not what the complicated view that these letters actually give us can portray, that she was a much more complicated individual than some of those overlying myths of being grumpy hermit, isolated, and hating Texas. So a little bit of rewriting history through her own words there, where she gets to speak rather than other people speak for her.
What a great motivation for compiling these letters, because you use the word complex. That is absolutely what I experienced, you know, from reading the letters. I was a little surprised because I think I had the myth in mind as well. And I want to ask you regarding her time spent with other men in the community. She's writing these letters to Stieglitz, and I wondered, you know, she trying to stimulate a little jealousy? She would talk about, I remember the blonde boy, a good-looking kid, and going to dances and whether she should go with this young man. And I was thinking about the audience of the letters. Yeah, as Stieglitz is reading this about a woman, you know, I think he's interested in. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. And sometimes you forget, because like you said, you're reading along and you feel like you're having this intimate conversation with O'Keefe, like she's talking to you, but then you remember who she's actually talking to. And she's actually talking to a man who was her dealer and supporter, and then quickly becoming kind of a like correspondent lover. She was, and she did see him in the spring of 1917 when she went back and saw her show, her first solo show hanging in his gallery, and they spent time together. And so that's when their intimacy would have been in person. But they were professing these kinds of romantic feelings for each other through those letters. And that's really what that other book by Sarah Greenough, My Faraway One, is all about, like this kind of love affair through these letters that kind of begins in Texas. But she definitely wasn't exclusive, and he wasn't either. He was married, we must remember, at this time, right? And so, but yeah, she was totally flirting with him in her writing, because she is saying how much she likes to be kissed, or how she lays on her bed nude, or how she'll say things like, you should have been in the back seat while I was kissing this man in the front seat, like toying with him. Absolutely. And I don't know if I think she was just kind of a bold flirt rather than a kind of manipulative shrew. But there's a little bit of that question of like, what really was she trying to do to Stieglitz? I think she was definitely trying to like arouse his interest romantically through these letters, even if it was playing with him, toying with him by describing her relationships with other men.
It's really something that doesn't fit my image of Georgia O'Keeffe, you know, being exactly as you describe. And I wonder too, on from his point of view, I believe it's in October, or I can't remember. I know that at some point, I believe it was October, he wrote her a 42-page letter. She refers to receiving a 42-page letter from Stieglitz.
Yes. I don't remember exactly the date either, but you're right. These letters were lengthy, but the way that I understand it is that it's almost like a journal for each of them. They talk about mundane things. They talk about, you know, going to a shopping or the post office. So it's like they put down everything that happened to them that day and all that they thought about and inspiring things and mundane things. And so, yeah, the 42-page letter was probably written over a few days, but it would describe all kinds of things that he was thinking about. They were like confidants, like deep confidants at this time. And so, yeah, he would write to, and sometimes she didn't even know what to make of such a letter, but I think she also wrote back of how much she enjoyed getting them in the mail and going to the post office and opening them and sneaking around to read them, because some of the people that were in the town would say, who is this person that you're getting these letters from? And, you know, she didn't want, I remember there's this one point where she says she doesn't want her landlord picking up her letters. Anything, she calls her the little fat lady or something like this. You know, she's always got this kind of biting judgment it's funny when you read it. And so she didn't want her sniffing around her letters kind of attitude. She wanted privacy. It's hard to have privacy when you're renting a room in someone else's house. It's hard to have privacy when you're a woman that has to keep up the social mores in public. And she would break those mores pretty like egregiously in ways where, you know, the young women at the college were mandated not to ride in cars with men, but that's the students. And she was a faculty member, so she kind of didn't care. And she would do what she wanted, or she'd take her shoes off and sit on the porch of the boarding house where she took her meals. I mean, women didn't just take their shoes off. You know, she would just really push on these social behaviors and, you know, kind of she wanted to scandalize a little bit. But the 42-page letter, I think, is something that all of them were quite lengthy. So what you're learning from this is like, you know, you can learn about their life, like their daily life. And these are really interesting people who lived really interesting lives. So, I mean, I've even heard somebody say that it's like the most complete correspondence of a married couple in history or something like this, you know, the O'Keefe Stieglitz correspondence. But you can also say maybe from O'Keefe's perspective, you know, you learn almost everything she thought and did in these 2 years. It's incredible insight into just life at the time and in the place.
And with that said, the war. And you, in your introduction, you help readers understand the context of the war. And, you know, O'Keefe is out west during the war. It's complicated again, but from the letters, what do you think, is it possible to even describe O'Keefe's take on the war and her, you know, her, is there a unified understanding she had of what's happening?
That's something that I really tried to tackle. When I first started this project, it wasn't about the war at all. But then by the time I was sort of done with it, it was the centennial of like America entering the war, right? So I was working on it in this moment when the war was being reviewed as an important historical moment. I started to like look for what she was saying in the letters about living in that war time or the buildup to war before America entered in April 1917. You know, or like treating her as a kind of wartime writer in a new way. And that evolved during the process of me producing this book. And she mentioned it a lot more times than I thought. And I think that was also something that I found like in her literature, which is so rich. Like there's so many wonderful books and scholarly articles and, you know, monographs and biographies about this woman because she is so interesting. But treating her during the wartime in World War I, nobody had done that. Like nobody saw her as a wartime artist because she wasn't making pictures about the war. But when you look at what she was saying and thinking, her pictures sort of become about the war in this new way. So I sort of wanted to newly think about her art and newly think about her perspective, because a lot of times she was just written off as a pacifist because she would be aligned with Stieglitz, who is a known pacifist, but thinking about how she had different opinions as a young woman, you know, a professional woman with a job on the American home front in middle America, it must be a different take than Stieglitz, who was a 52-year-old man in New York City. You know, like those politics can't be the same. And so that's really what I spent some time thinking about. What I teased out is that, again, this idea of like the complexities of it come to light. Like on some days she wants to go fight and she can't because she's a woman. And on some days she wants everyone to just shut up about it. She's sick of it. And on other days she's sad because some of her friends from the college were called up to war and she knows she might never see them again. You know, and then on other days, she's actually corresponding with Stieglitz about aspects of the war. And so I think that, you know, we can learn about how hard it was, just like we're living through this pandemic. I mean, nobody really knows what to say about it. It's very complicated. And I think that's how it was for her. Like day to day, it was rough and strange and sad and normal too. She had to keep tying her shoes and going to work. And, you know, like she had to live a normal life. But at the same time, she knew that this global conflict was occurring, and there were these minutes that it would come into her consciousness. And I really wanted that to come out in the book. One of the ways I did it was with italics. So like, if you look through the text, the wartime mentions are in italics. So you could like skim the pages and look for war stuff. I don't know if that really worked, but I thought that was one way to just kind of highlight how it would come and go in her consciousness.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, absolutely. As a reader, I really thought that was effective. And coming into the project, and I think other readers would be like this, I didn't even think of her as a wartime artist. You're absolutely nailing down a point. I just never even wondered what her thoughts were, because I think of her art and the abstract quality of the art. And thinking about the art she was making at the time, and in your introduction, you find some resonances even within that abstraction with the war. I'm wondering, there's a quote I wanted to ask you about regarding the art. This is a letter to Stieglitz, April 13th, 1917. And O'Keefe says, "I want to pick holes in everything folks call art, everything folks call art. I'm not trying to do art. I'm digging stars." What do you make of that?
This is why I love her as a writer. She says so many times, like, words and me don't go together, or like, I'm not good with words. Well, that's a lie to me, you know, because she wrote privately. She didn't publish it, but it's still, she had a way with words. And this idea of digging stars, I mean, what does that even mean? I love this. And then she does that beautiful piece where it's the landscape of the Panhandle. It's a rectangular, small watercolor, where the land itself is this kind of like darkened color, the sky is this bluish green color, and the stars are holes in her color. Like they're the paper coming through, and they're kind of like square and sort of strange shaped, not totally like a grid, but like an organic grid. And so this idea of like her kind of digging at infinity, or digging at the cosmos, and, you know, that idea of like, what is reality during war? Or, you know, it really gets at that struggle to make art, struggle. She had so many ideas in her head, and she really didn't know how to form them. And she struggled to form these ideas. And that idea of like digging a star, like going down to go up. I mean, there's such complications in that phraseology. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to like throw her out there almost as a poet. You know, and I'm not like a literary scholar, so I'm not the expert at words. I'm more of an expert at images and art. But the beauty of the correspondence between her words and her images, I just felt like other people could make more of this too than I did. And that's why I wanted them accessible.
And that is a real inspiration for artistic-minded people of all types or historically minded people to look at the book. I was blown away by the I'm Digging Stars. And related, she keeps talking in the letters about this red painting she's working on. And she gets very, you know, agitated, and she has something's going on with the red. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I think I actually talked about that on the previous podcast too, because it's something that stood out a lot in her, like when I was looking at the letters in light of her watercolors and her few oil paintings. There's this really good painting where she's learning to do oils. So it's lumpy. It's not like the best oil painting that she did, you know, after Stieglitz, like after 1918, when she returned to New York and really focused on getting the skill set for oil. But it's a very, like, it's a beautiful painting because of its, like, moment in time and its reds and its representation of the canyon. It's in the Palo Duro, no, excuse me, it's in the Panhandle Plains Museum on the campus where I work, so at West Texas A&M now. And the museum was not founded when she was there, but it has this piece, and it shows the kind of craggy walls that are this rich, bloody red. And obviously the canyon walls that she fell in love with out here in the canyonlands of Texas are very similar to the ones she continued to live among in Ghost Ranch and Abiquiu and in New Mexico. And obviously they're not red, like red, blood red. They're more of like, you know, like a kind of earthy orange color. But she thought that red was symbolic, and she kept thinking through red. Like, she talked about her body as red, like the big landscape. She talked about red blood cells of people she liked, redness as passion, redness as like living a full life rather than like being hypocritical or living a confined life based on, you know, following all the social rules. I think there's so much to red that she talks about. She finds red in the landscape and then makes it mean in her mind. And it's this really powerful color for these years. She even deviates from red to do pink too. And like, you know, her body is kind of this pinkish red that's made with Brazil wood pigments in her watercolors versus that rich oil, lumpy oil, craggy red that she uses for the landscape. So you could do like a really cool study of like her reds in the Texas years where you just looked at like what she wrote about red and what she, how she represented red in her art. But it is this really powerful color for her at that time. And she even does, sorry, I'm like going on, but she even does these amazing abstract portraits of men that she loved or dated. One of them is Paul Strand, and the other one is this man named Watkins. And the reds in there are like bloody, throbbing, passionate, you know, sexy reds. So it's all of it. It's the war, and it's love, and it's life, and it's landscape. Yeah, red is so potent for her.
I think you're describing your next book project, perhaps. Oh, you know, no. Just to isolate the red. I think that the whole, anyone interested in O'Keeffe's color, your first book on the watercolors, this collection of letters, they are must reads. And since you mentioned Paul Strand, maybe you could tell us a little bit about this interesting dynamic among Strand, O'Keeffe, and Stieglitz.
Yeah, one of the most bizarre love triangles in history, maybe, I don't know. So one of the things that you can read in the letters and also read in Sarah Greenough's book in a different way, because she does the back and forth between Stieglitz and O'Keeffe, and I'm only doing the O'Keeffe take on it. But the strange thing is, after O'Keeffe, she gets sick, and talk about my next book. It's so funny. So she gets sick in November of 1917. And stays ill through that spring of 1918, quits the job at WT, and relocates to San Antonio to kind of recuperate her health. It's an upper respiratory flu-like undiagnosed illness. Now, people always say it's Spanish flu, right? Because the Spanish flu started in 1918. But usually the Spanish flu is dated to the summer. Right. So she would have had it like 8 months earlier than the first case. But as we know with the pandemic going on right now, we don't really know when it started. So maybe my next book would be like, did O'Keefe have the Spanish flu? I don't know. But this all leads up to the fact that she's in San Antonio and Stieglitz is super worried about her because of her health. And he writes these letters that basically say, there's no good doctors down there, come back to New York. But her doctors are actually saying you're better off in San Antonio because of the climate for upper respiratory, fine. Okay, so she stays there. Stieglitz tells Strand, who O'Keefe also had feelings for, and Stieglitz knew this, to go down and get her. And he doesn't go himself. He never leaves New York. The man does not come to the West with her ever, even during their marriage. He sends Strand down to retrieve her. Strand moves in with her and her friend Leah, who are like living in this kind of rural lifestyle, pretending to be farmers or something, you know, outside of San Antonio. And he hangs out with them for a while, and then she just up and gets on a train and returns to Stieglitz. So Strand never retrieves her, if that's what Stieglitz wanted. And there's a few kind of sexual tension letters between Strand and O'Keefe that, of course, she's writing back to Stieglitz, titillating him yet again. But it's very weird. And I think in the end, O'Keefe is kind of fed up with Strand's, like, I don't know, like inability to just up and go to war, inability to figure out his stuff, and is more drawn to Stieglitz in the end. And that's when she goes back and, you know, stays in New York. So this strange tension is going on in these letters that you can see with two different lovers of O'Keefe, one of which sends the other one to retrieve her and bring her back to New York. Is that strange? That's so strange.
Yes, it is strange. I would have to agree. And it's kind of unresolved. It's unresolved in an, I guess, a very human way. And you mentioned Leah. I found Leah in the letters to be such an intriguing character. Can you tell us anything else about Leah and how she and O'Keefe came to be friends?
Yes, Leah is one of the really strong kind of characters, if you want to call them characters, in the book, because she is a friend that is about the same age as O'Keefe, I assume, young, kind of almost 30-year-old professional woman. She drives a car around, and she is like a health demonstrator. So she goes around almost like a nutritionist, right? And so she drives through the panhandle and demonstrates about, you know, health consciousness, or, you know, and her brother-in-law is a doctor. So her sister is married to this doctor that's also becomes O'Keefe's doctor and friend. Leah is from the San Antonio area, and her dad is a newspaper man in the San Antonio area. And then when they both get sick, because they both come down with this like flu-like sickness, that's when Leah convinces O'Keefe to come back and live with her in the San Antonio area on this farm in Waring, Texas. And they're so close. I mean, one could even read a kind of sexual tension between Leah and O'Keefe, but it's not, it's a little bit like the Maria Chabot letters where there's this sexual tension, but it's never really obvious that that is there. It's just this deep, deep friendship, especially between Leah and O'Keefe, because they're the same age. They lay in a bed together, like holding hands, you know, but Strand is there too. So, and they don't really talk about doing anything sexual. So it's this very, very interesting. But what I find so interesting is how close she was to Leah. And then Leah disappears, fully disappears. I don't know if they had a falling out. I don't know if she just wanted to get out of town and go back to be a Stieglitz and turn the corner in her life and never looked back. But, you know, she does maintain some contact with people she met in Canyon, like Ted Reed, who is the man she almost married. But she never, as far as I know, and I haven't read every single letter that she wrote. Maybe she mentions Leah later, but I haven't found it yet. And so one of the things that Linda Grasso writes about in her book on O'Keefe and feminism is how O'Keefe often wants to downplay her women-to-women relationships, almost so that she seems like she does it all on her own. And I think that's a really interesting point, because Leah really kind of rescues her and becomes her family in a way. And then later, you know, when she returns to New York and draws on Stieglitz's help and connections, she cuts that out almost and doesn't mention it in her biography later, almost forgotten in her life. But it was a very important moment that those letters do show, in a friendship that's very real. So third book, who knows how many books. Okay, I'm going to do the pandemic one. Maybe I'll also track Leah, because she's an interesting person, but I don't know what there is to track. I haven't looked into that.
It is an abrupt departure.
And then when O'Keefe goes to New York, I almost felt like, oh no, this is over now. And that brings me to another question. What is the missing, maybe you've already answered it with regard to Leah, what's the missing letter that you want to find? You know, what, if there's something that's not yet connected in the letters or something missing, in addition to finding out more about what happened with Leah, is there anything like your dream letter to find in an archive?
Oh my gosh, what a good question. So I don't know what that dream letter is, but I did find, well, a woman in town who was the granddaughter of Ted Reed, this cowboy who O'Keefe almost married, walked into my office with handwritten letters from O'Keefe to Reed that were sent in the 40s and then later, even when she was older. That was a dream moment because I found later things that connected back to the Texas years that have been written out of most biographies. I mean, because they lived in the panhandle. This is one of the things that happens with, you know, regional areas out of sight, out of mind. Like if it's not on the radar of scholars on the coast, it's missing from the narrative because who's going to come out here and dig in the panhandle except someone living there, you know, or something like this. So that was a really cool find. I would love to find more after letters that connect to these people that she might have stayed in touch with from the Canyon years. And now that I know them all, now they're all indexed, maybe that'll come out. That's one thing I spent a heck of a lot of time on in this book. And no one, I think, will care about this but me. But maybe some O'Keefe lovers will, too, because people get very obsessed with, you know, how many times did she mention the color green in these letters? It's in the index, right? So you can really play that game of, like, what did she think about shotguns? What did she think about, you know, pick any topic. If she mentioned it in those letters, I tried to get it into that index so that people could really go to that letter and dip into the book, too, to find out every time Leah was mentioned or every time she talked about green. So I would love to find those letters about some people she might have kept in touch with, like the Ted Reed case later in her life. That would be magical.
What an incredible story to have a descendant just show up with letters. Isn't that just kind of mind blowing from my point of view? And then to definitely maybe someone listening to this podcast has a connection and knows where there are some letters so that you could build out the people in her life and how they, you know, corresponded or affected her as she moved on. That would be wonderful. Maybe one additional topic that we haven't gotten into is how O'Keefe saw herself as a teacher and what she thought of her students. When I was reading the letters, she had some interesting comments like, well, education is like a machine. School is like a machine. But at other times she was so excited. She had, I think it was a still life set up. And she was so excited that the students were going to be painting the still life and it went really well. Do you have a take on her, you know, her identity as a teacher at this time?
That is something that I think I've spent the most time thinking about, and that has become a new thread in my research. So the fact that women who were kind of under-recognized or underselling compared to some of their male colleagues, one of the ways that they supported themselves and found inspiration and made connections and had a professional career was through teaching. So I'm working on a number of other artists in this vein for other projects. But O'Keefe's teaching, it was like up to 1918, she was a pretty serious educator. She, like, this is what she saw herself doing. She was proud of her voice as an educator and public speaker. She, you know, even was doing conferencing. I love this idea that right when she got sick, like around Thanksgiving of 1917, she had been to Waco, Texas, where she also saw her brother who was in training camp as a soldier. And so that wartime moment comes in, but she also was going down there to speak on behalf of like the Texas Teachers Association. And even her letters are written on Texas Teachers Association letterhead. I might be getting the organization name a little bit wrong, but you get the point, right? So she's speaking on behalf of her institution in an association of teachers. And later in her life, she was never really this person that was like a public speaker, educator. She kind of stopped having to be a teacher after Stieglitz came into her life, and she started actually selling her work and became one of the most successful women studio artists. I mean, her art has sold for the highest amount worldwide of any woman artist of all time. Right. So like she was a successful, financially successful studio artist. But I think that she also loved the teaching aspect. She loved the engagement with students. She would just inspire people on the street to kind of follow her. She was sort of like a prophet. And that's one of the things I would like to look more into, is how like her teaching carried over into the way that she would, her relationship, say, with like Maria Chabot or some of the other people that she engaged with in Abiquiu. I know that she funded college funds for some of the townspeople. And so she was always sort of like being a kind of prophet educator, but not in a formal manner. And what you can look at in the letters in Texas is her formal manner of education, because she would talk about loving faculty meetings. I don't know who in the world loves faculty meetings, but she did. And, you know, her voice as a kind of radical thinker for the future of education comes through. So yeah, teaching and women artists is a thread in the book that is also a thread that I think needs more research in the field of like art history and gender studies, where they overlap. I think that's an excellent point that I'm glad you asked, so I got to make it.
Well, I'm just hoping, and I just know that anyone who's listening to the podcast realizes that in this volume, which looks deceptively slim, there are many themes that come out from this small, you know, short period of time in O'Keefe's life. And I really appreciate the time you've given us today to help us sort of get the sense of what is in the letters and what people can take from the letters. And I just want to thank you for your time. And I hope we can have you back on the podcast when you get the next book done. And again, thank you very much.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you for having me again. And I look forward to doing this whenever some new studies come out. This is just a wonderful thing that you do, especially during this time where people need the voice to calm them. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.